I've been asked to speak about how Srila Prabhupada's books came about. So that's what I'll do. Of course, one place you can begin is at Radhakund, where Srila Prabhupada was on Parikrama and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur instructed him, if you ever get money print books, you can go back even further actually to when Prabhupada first met his Guru Maharaj, and his Guru Maharaj instructed him that whatever you should preach, you should spread Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's message in English. And then again, just before his departure, the same instruction. Whatever you've learned from me, try to spread in English. Prabhupada mentioned one time, he said, practically everything I learned from my father, the chanting Hare Krishna, playing Mridanga, Ratiyatra festival, distributing prasadam. He said, but this I learned from my Guru Maharaj, publishing books. Prabhupada said, I saw that he was very keen to publish books. Of course, going back even earlier, so many devotees in our sampradaya have written books. Going back to Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, and so on, coming down to the Goswamis and their followers, and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And then Srila Prabhupada comes on the scene. So, as he told us, that his godbrothers mostly, who were doing something, were mostly, they constructed temples and so on. But Prabhupada instead focused on books. He published those first three volumes, first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, and also began the Back to Godhead before that. And then he came to America. In America, when I came, the Bhagavatam was already published from India. Easy Journey to Other Planets was already there from India. Not much more. But Prabhupada had, of course, he'd started the Back to Godhead also. At one point, the history is there in Prabhupada Lilamrita. He basically spent all the cash available to buy two second-hand small printing machines, I don't know if they were hand-run, but anyway, very small, like duplicating machines practically. And with those, the devotees began the Back to Godhead again in America. But I'm going to talk more about Back to Godhead. I'll talk about books. The first book, of course, Srila Prabhupada continued with the Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto and onwards. But the two books that he worked on before I came, I joined in 1968. So before that time, Prabhupada had worked on two books. One was the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Prabhupada, when I came, I saw that some of the old typewriters, Prabhupada had a closet with like three or four old beat up typewriters. And on one of his typewriters, he'd begun typing the Bhagavad Gita manuscript, which he typed up till about sixth chapter or seventh chapter, with two fingers. And at one point, Gargamuni passed by a store and saw a dictating machine in the window. And he somehow had the thought that maybe Swamiji could use this for his books. And he talked to the man in the store and wound up buying the machine and brought it to Prabhupada. And from there on, Prabhupada wrote his books by speaking them. Prabhupada recounted that one time, I believe in the airport in Tokyo, he had met a young fellow who had asked him, where do you get the knowledge that you, all that knowledge that's in your books? And of course, Srila Prabhupada, there are two answers. One is that, one Prabhupada gave in a news conference, or a discussion with a news reporter, in New York City, I believe. The reporter had asked Srila Prabhupada, you know, how do you know what to write? And Prabhupada said, Krishna tells me. And then there was a senior devotee with Srila Prabhupada, and he began explaining to the man that Prabhupada receives this knowledge in a line, and so Prabhupada said, no, Krishna tells me. So that's one answer. Another answer is that Srila Prabhupada, of course, received this knowledge through the disciplic succession, evam parampara praptam, imam rajarshi ovidu. And when writing his books, he used to consult the commentaries written by the previous acharyas. Sometimes when I would ask Prabhupada a question in connection with editorial affairs, I learned after some time that it would be sensible to send Srila Prabhupada a copy of the page with the commentaries that he was using, because then Prabhupada would look back, or could look back and see, you know, the context of the question, rather than just my mailing him a question out of the sky. For Bhagavad Gita as it is, by looking at the text, we can understand that Srila Prabhupada especially consulted the commentary of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Srila Baladev Bijabhushan, to whom he dedicates the book. And Prabhupada's commentary often follows quite closely the commentary of Srila Baladev Bijabhushan. We'll also sometimes see Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who also wrote a commentary on Bhagavad Gita, and Bhaktivinod Thakur, perhaps Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, but especially Baladev Vishwanath, sometimes Bhaktivinod Thakur, they all show up, as it were, in Prabhupada's commentaries. So Prabhupada was drawing upon the works of the previous acharyas. So Prabhupada's writing Bhagavad Gita first by typing and then by dictating. The dictating made it possible for him to go much faster. It also created some problems because someone had to transcribe the dictation, and various devotees had a go at it with varying degrees of failure and success. And at one point, a young man showed up named Neil, who was a student at Antioch College in America, and who was came to 26 Second Avenue on one of those work-study sort of projects. And the devotees asked him, do you know how to type? He said, sure. So he was engaged as the typist. And till then, the devotees were having a hard time because the dictaphone, or Prabhupada called it a dictaphone, which is a trademark, but it was a dictating machine made by originally a German company, Grundig. Not Ewer. Ewer was a tape recorder much later. That was advanced technology. Grundig. Thank you. A Grundig dictating machine. And it had, for the transcriber, it had a foot pedal by which you could advance the tape. It had a little tape. Advance the tape forward or go back, just as you could with the microphone. The microphone had a switch to do that. But if you're typing, you wouldn't want to have a hand switch, so you had a foot pedal. But the devotees were sitting on the floor and typing. And manipulating that pedal with your knee was something of a, you know, we didn't believe in tables and chairs back then. But then Neil, who was a little more connected with the world, set up some milk boxes and a flat surface and a chair. And he became the transcriber and did a lot of the work on Bhagavad Gita as it is. Fortunately, Srila Prabhupada early on met a assistant or associate professor of English, Howard Wheeler, who became Hayagriva Prabhu, and he was Prabhupada's first editor. I believe the first, maybe not first, but anyway, very early. And he was entrusted. At first, actually, Brahmananda Prabhu told me the manuscript was going to anyone who had any sort of education to try to edit it. That didn't work. And finally it wound up in the hands of Hayagriva Prabhu, who was qualified to do that sort of work. Prabhupada explained what he wanted. Basically, fix the grammar, fix the spelling, and don't edit too much, and don't change the message. That was Hayagriva Prabhu's job. And that was his service. At some point, I don't have the dates in my mind, but it's there in Prabhupada Lilamrita. Prabhupada had a stroke, and his health failed. At one point, he went to California to a place called Stinson Beach to try to recover his health. But the weather was gray and it didn't help. And Prabhupada came back to New York and then went to India. And while he was in Stinson Beach, Hayagriva was coming up and going back and forth from San Francisco while working on the Gita manuscript and sometimes asking questions. And he recounts in one of his books that he would ask a question and Prabhupada would, maybe start on answering the question and then just begin preaching. And when Hayagriva would come with another question, there'd be more preaching. So Kirtananda said, stop asking him questions. Whenever you ask a question, he just preaches and you'll tire him out. Prabhupada also, at one point, Hayagriva asked various questions about the translations. And Prabhupada said, just use any translation. There are so many translations out there. Hayagriva said, that's plagiarism. Prabhupada said, it's Krishna's words. So Hayagriva Prabhu did that. He borrowed extensively from published translations as well as using material from Prabhupada's manuscript. And Prabhupada considered the purports to be the more important contribution. He said, Dr. Radhakrishnan, as a scholar, he was all right. His translations were generally okay. But, of course, his purport was, Prabhupada has said a lot of things about his purports. He's gained eternal notoriousness by Srila Prabhupada's blessings. So Prabhupada went back to India, and at that point he didn't know if he was coming back or if he would live. So he wrote letters to Hayagriva that somehow or other these books, you have to publish these books. I may live or die, but these books should be published. So that was his service. And not so much later, I joined. When Prabhupada was in India, I joined at 26 Second Avenue. By that time, that was late 1968. By that time, Hayagriva Prabhu had left for some time. Kirtanananda had gone off course, and he and Hayagriva were old friends, so Hayagriva was pulled out and stopped working on Bhagavad Gita. In the meantime, there was another devotee who had joined around the same time as Hayagriva, or perhaps earlier, I'm not quite sure who was first, named Ray Rama, who was a writer for comic books. Raymond Murray, his name was. He used to write for Dell Comics and those sort of people. And he took up the work of editing. What happened was that Prabhupada, the manuscript was there, and Prabhupada considered it done, edited or not edited or fully edited or whatever state it was in, just finish it up and publish it. So the work of publishing was given to Brahmananda, who was our first temple president and first president of ISKCON in New York City. And, temple president meant president of ISKCON back then, because at first there was only one temple, and a few others appeared. The Prabhupada gave him the task of publishing, and of course he'd never published a book, had no idea how to do it. But he'd gone around to various publishers and tried to, New York City is the publishing capital of America, tried to get the book published, no response. And then a letter came from the Macmillan Company, which was a major publisher at that time, ordering a copy of Prabhupada's recording of Hare Krishna Mantra. So Brahmananda got very excited. There was a letter from Macmillan. Prabhupada told him that deliver the record personally and tell him that we have a Bhagavad Gita to publish. Tell them we have a Bhagavad Gita to publish. So Brahmananda went up to wherever it is in Midtown Manhattan with the record and found himself in the office of a clerk at Macmillan. So he was just somebody in the accounting department who'd ordered the record. And, the accounting department has nothing to do with anything as far as the editorial side of a publishing house goes. They count the money. So Premananda was disheartened. But while he was talking to this man, another fellow came in. And the man Brahmananda was talking to, so this is Mr. Wade. He's one of our chief editors. So Brahmananda said, very pleased to meet you. We have a Bhagavad Gita to publish. The man said, we're just looking for a Bhagavad Gita. Bring the manuscript, we'll publish it. Macmillan was publishing some series of books, and in that series they needed a Bhagavad Gita. So, but they needed it trimmed down. They needed it to fit within a certain number of pages at a certain size, which meant heavy abridgment. So Ray Rama was asked to finish the book. He flew out to Los Angeles and met with Srila Prabhupada, and together the decisions were made what to keep in and what to keep out. Of course, all the word-for-word meanings in Sanskrit were all deleted. All the translations were kept, and a lot of the purports were either shortened or deleted. And that became the first published edition of Bhagavad Gita, the abridged edition. That wasn't the first book to come out, though, because meanwhile, Srila Prabhupada had written Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Teachings of Lord Chaitanya was edited by Ray Rama and printed at Dainippon Printing Company in Tokyo, and with whom Prabhupada established quite a long-lasting and productive relationship. They did the typesetting out there in Japan. And published the book, and Brahmananda Prabhu personally went out to Japan to get all the things, get all the work done, and in fact get it done on some sort of super deadline that Prabhupada had in mind, and successfully brought back the published book, Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. That came out just after I joined, I think. And then after that, the Bhagavad Gita came out from the Macmillan Company, which meant that now we had books. We had Srimad Bhagavatam. We had Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. We had this Bhagavad Gita. But especially the teaching, of course, selling Bhagavad Gita was Macmillan's job as the publishers. But Teachings of Lord Chaitanya was all with us. And it wasn't selling. It was just basically delivered and sitting. And Prabhupada wasn't very happy about that. And he was, so the devotees were trying this way or that way to find ways to market a book. And mostly thinking in terms of, well, how do publishers sell books? And they weren't having much success. Later, of course, they learned how to do it. Now, Teachings of Lord Chaitanya was the first book. Ishopanishad had been published in Back to Godhead in India, and Ray Rama later edited it, and it was published in parts in the Back to Godhead in America. And yes, Back to Godhead in America. And sometime later, it was published in, as a book by ISKCON Press, which we'll come to. Meanwhile, by 1972, the sales of the abridged Bhagavad Gita had apparently been quite satisfactory, and the Macmillan Company agreed to publish the complete unabridged edition. Complete unabridged edition. By that time, Ray Rama had left and Hayagriva had come back. Let's see, what time, when was that Prabhupada talked about that? Maybe it was 1968 or 1969. Prabhupada said, now we want to publish the unabridged book. It was December of either 68 or 69. Somehow 69 or sticks in my mind. I don't think it was 1970, but it could have been. So that charge Hayagriva Prabhu took up. He dug up his old manuscripts or recovered manuscripts. Some were still with Ray Rama's office or with Brahmananda. Some were older manuscripts who were with Hayagriva. And he went through them again, changed some of the translations, replaced them with, reconsidered and did new versions of some of the translations, re-edited some of the purports. We wrote to Srila Prabhupada because there was some sections where the purports were missing, so I wrote to Prabhupada and said, these are missing, and Prabhupada dictated them fresh. And Prabhupada wrote a preface to the book, the introduction he'd already dictated. We don't have any of the dictations from Teachings of Lord Chaitanya or Bhagavad Gita as it is, except for the introduction, which Prabhupada spoke apparently as a lecture. It may have been to an empty room, in fact, but that recording is still there. It's the only recording from Prabhupada's dictating of Bhagavad Gita as it is. I was the production manager for the Bhagavad Gita. By this time, I should also say, at the time I joined in 1968, there were some disciples of Srila Prabhupada who were learning printing. One devotee, Advaita, another devotee, Uddhava, another devotee, Patita, Uddharan, was learning binding. So their idea was that we could start a press and print Prabhupada's books. So they were very seriously learning the printing trade. They were working in the printing trade. And sometime later, Prabhupada was desiring to start a press. He was thinking maybe in New Vrindavan because we had property there. But then the devotees at the Boston Temple acquired a large house, which would be big enough to house a press. And so that became the first press. It became ISKCON Press. We had two fairly large printing machines, serious printing machines, not the little small things that Back to Godhead was done on, but regular sheet-fed printing presses. And Advaita and Uddhava and the other devotees began a proper production line with graphic cameras, because you had to shoot the pages and make films from them, and then you had to do what was called imposition, which meant putting the negatives in different patterns so that when the pages were folded, you would get what are called signatures, and then you sew the signatures together, and then you get a book. So all of these various arts they were learning, and they purchased the equipment, and we started ISKCON Press. We also had, for typesetting, we had composing machines, as they were called. Now you just do it on your desktop or your laptop, or you could even do it on your iPad, I suppose, these days. But back then we used what were called Selectric composing machines. The IBM company had tremendous success in the offices, in the office business market, with what was called the Selectric typewriter, which was a revolutionary thing, because instead of having keys, I guess you would call them, but you pressed a key and then this little bar came up with a letter on it and banged into the ribbon, and that's how the letter was impressed on the page. But they came up with a brand new thing which had a little ball, and the balls had all the letters on it, and it spun around according to some machinery, and the ball would hit the right place, and you get the right letter. And it was rigged up in such a way that for the typing was very easy. You didn't have to press real hard to make this bar go up. It was every decent office in America, practically speaking, any office of any size, had a Selectric typewriter in it. A huge hit in the 1960s. But this was a different machine, because the typewriter just typed and you got lines. But the Selectric composing machine, which was based on some of the same technology, but which added a lot more, justified the columns, which is a big deal. To make the columns come out even was quite an accomplishment. And anyway, they figured out a way to do it. And it also allowed you to replace the balls so that you could have different typefaces. You could have italic, you could have bold, you could have Roman, you could have different faces. This was also quite something. So this put it into the realm of serious typesetting. Typesetting in those days was done with what was called hot metal. The Mergenthaler Linotype Company, and in this country, the Monotype Company, had invented machines which involved typing, which produced a slug with actual letters formed from molten metal, and those letters would be produced in lines. The lines would be manually assembled into pages, and that's how books were typeset in those days. Later, it was automated somewhat so that you punched paper tape, and then the paper tape gave you the metal letters. But it was, anyway, that was typesetting back then. And IBM came on the scene with this machine, which allowed you to do what was called cold type. That became hot type, and now cold type was, or strike-on composition, meant that the you could do without all that metal, and it would produce an image on the page, as typewriters do, but it would be of higher quality, and it would be acceptable for typesetting. It wasn't the very best typesetting, but for ordinary books, it was quite acceptable. So that's what we used. We acquired Hayagriva's wife, Shyamadasi, became the first composer, the first person to use this machine. And later we got a second machine, and both machines came to Boston. The machines cost about $5,000 a piece, which in those days was big money, and especially for ISKCON, it was big money. But we had two of them. It was a chore, by the way. None of you will ever typeset a book the way that we did. The way the machine worked, each page was typed twice. First you typed it, you drew a line down the right-hand side of the page, you got as close, you typed until you got close to the line, and then there would be, the way the machine worked, there would be a number and a color that would show up. You would write, you would tab over and you'd write the name of the number and a letter for the color, like Y3 for yellow 3. And each line you would write that. Then you would go back and retype the entire page or the entire book. And this time you would set a dial according to what you'd written there. So you'd set the dial to Y3 or B2 or whatever it was. And that would tell the machine how much space to insert between the various words on the line. And so it would come out justified. Every page had to be typed twice. Well, that's not so bad, is it? Now, every time you change from italic to bold, or bold to Roman, or Roman to italic, you have to change the ball. So, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, change, manmana bhava madbhakta, change. One should take up this method of devotional service, change, bhakti, change. Every time you change from Roman to italic, you're physically taking the ball out and putting it back in again. That's not so hard, is it? Now you have to type in the diacritic marks. The diacritic marks, where do you get the diacritic marks? Well, you have X number of letters on this little ball, and some of them you have to sacrifice to put the diacritic marks in with. So you would take a letter like something like an acute accent or a dollar sign or something that you wouldn't use very often, and you'd make that a D with a dot under it, or an H with a dot under it, or an A with a line over it. And so now you would have to key in, and there was a sequence for, you know, knowing that this, you press this key to get that letter. Okay. And the R was particularly weird because it was a floating dot, and so you would have to do something like advance two spaces, hit the dot, go back one space, go to the next letter. It was some sort of weird thing like that. I've forgotten exactly the mechanics of it, but it was a little extra work. Well, that's not so hard, is it? Then these balls, which were custom-made balls, were only made by one company, Camwell Company, Camwell Industries in Honolulu, Hawaii. And they cost a lot of money. They were like $150 a piece for the balls. And they broke. The balls had little teeth on the bottom, and if a tooth would go missing, then you would be out of alignment. So But buying new balls was really a problem. We got to a stage where some of the diacritics were on a working ball, some were on another working ball, and then there were the regular balls for the regular. So people would be choosing which ball they were using to get which set of diacritic marks while we were sending away to Camel for another replacement and so on and so on. A lot of work went into this. We took those two machines and ran them 24 hours a day because we had a lot of work to do and we didn't have a lot of money and we weren't going to buy, you know, four machines. I'd spent a summer in the Merchant Marine in America, and the schedules that they had for the deckhands and the cooks and the people who were steering the ship was 4 hours on, 8 hours off. So you would work like 12 to 4, midnight to 4 a.m. Then you'd have 8 hours off till 4 p.m. Then you'd work, till 12 noon. Then you work till 4 again, and then you were off till 12. Or you'd start at 4 and you'd work till 12 and till, yeah, like that. There was a 12 to 4 shift, a 4 to 8, and an 8 to 12. And whichever shift it was, that was both a.m. and p.m. So I instituted that schedule for the composing machines, and we were literally running them around the clock. We had some mostly ladies, Mahamaya Dasi, Balai Dasi, Ragatmika Dasi, and others, Palika Dasi, who, and there are some more, the names will come to me later. They were doing this work. I was also doing some of it. That was composing. Oh, and if you made a mistake, well, the first time you could make a mistake and you could just X through the line and type it again because it was just a rough copy. The second time, it was typed on special paper which had clay in it so that you'd make a deep impression. And what if you typed word wrong? What if you made a spelling error or any kind of error? Then we would have to do the line again separately and paste it on. These typed pages, by the way, were later sprayed with a fixative. Somebody would hold this fixative outside the window and spray the pages. And then the type would be physically assembled and glued onto sheets using what's called light tables, which meant there was a light shining in the back onto these sheets, which had faint blue lines on them, and you would line up the type according to the pattern. And devotees like Yamaraj Das, who's still at Bhakti Godhead, and others would lay out these pages. But when there were errors, then there would be what we called correction sheets, and then we'd go back to the composers, and they would have to do sometimes a whole paragraph again or a line again, or when we cheat, sometimes just a word again. If a diacritic mark was wrong, for example, all redone. So a tremendous amount of work went into the typesetting. In Boston is bitter cold. You don't get cold like Boston here. You get just sort of average, miserable, chilly weather. But Boston gets ice, snow, Arctic winds blowing in from the bay because it's on the coast. Boston in the winter is austere. And in this house, we had one composing machine that was on this landing. It had previously been a mortician's place, and there was a nice landing where the stiffs could arrive. So that's where our press was set up, and there was a little room there for one of the composing machines, and the other composing machine was in the basement. Neither place was warm. The basement was so cold, you know, cinder block walls in a sunken basement, and middle of January in Boston. It's like maximum freezing. And so there's Pali Kadasi wearing gloves and typing on the 12 to 4 shift, midnight to 4 a.m. And then the devotees would, you know, the 4 a.m. person would go to Mangal Arati, and then that was the end of the day till hours later. So it gives you some idea of the extent of the dedication and sacrifice that these devotees had. We came out with the first books from Boston. They began publishing Back to Godhead. There were difficulties because this was a one-color sheet-fed press, and the covers for the Back to Godhead, of course, were four colors. That involved running the same sheet four times through the press, one time for each color. And that involves what's called registration, meaning you have to hit the same spot each time, otherwise you get funny-looking faces. And there were a lot of funny-looking faces. But they did it. Some issues of Back to Godhead, and then Ishopanishad may have been the first book they turned out. And that was, yeah, that was done in Boston at ISKCON Press. And Nectar of Devotion was also done at ISKCON Press. The first Nectar of Devotion was done. It was sent to Prabhupada in Los Angeles. Prabhupada opened it up and the pages started falling out. The binding was not expert. So there were serious problems with ISKCON Press, but the devotees struggled on and in some ways became more capable, in other ways didn't. But we published other books. Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada had us. The Nectar of Devotion was published right around the time that deity worship was begun, and Prabhupada made Los Angeles the world headquarters and was teaching the devotees how to do the basic things that we do every day. Things like Mangal Arati were introduced. And the Nectar of Devotion was the law book, how to do all this stuff. Till then, ISKCON was quite primitive in its devotional program. It had a lot of enthusiasm, but not a lot of knowledge or a lot of what would you say? Regulation? Not a lot of regulation, and not much development in Archon, in the work of the service to the deities and the various things that went with that. So that was all introduced through the Nectar of Devotion. Prabhupada wrote that book at that time. That was also edited by Ray Rama. And with a light final touch by Hayagriva, because it was during Nectar of Devotion, after basically finishing Nectar of Devotion, that Ray Rama left. And Hayagriva came back. So Hayagriva just did a little bit at the end. The transcription, by that time, a lot was being done by Satsvarup Maharaj. It was all, the tapes were being sent to Boston, and Satsvarup Maharaj had that service of typing the tapes. And he would also do a first editing of that dictation. And Prabhupada began Krishna Book also, for which the artists, Jadarani was our first artist, and other girls came and joined her, and men also, Bharadraj, Muralidhar, Pariksit. So we got an art department in Boston. And paintings were being done under Prabhupada's direction. Krishna Book and Bhagavatam, Prabhupada had us start publishing in chapter booklets. Because we weren't so speedy, and by the time we would come out with a, so Prabhupada had us just do, he gave us this idea that you do a chapter and then publish each chapter, and then when you have all the chapters, publish a canto. So that's what we did for second canto. We were coming out with little booklets, The Lord and the Heart, First Step in God Realization. These were all published as little booklets. There was an incident in sometime around then that on the Prabhupada's name evolved on teachings of Lord Chaitanya, it was A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Then gradually it became His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And then under that, at some point, this line was added, Founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which wasn't always, you know, hadn't been there in the very beginning. It was, you know, just probably, it was A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami International Society, but there wasn't codified. And at one point, one of those books we put, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, one of the first ones, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Then the word came from Los Angeles, this was all wrong, founder is supposed to be there. So they ran the book through the press again, ran a black line through Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and printed another line under it, founder of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So then we were in trouble again. And finally they got it right, founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which is what it's been since then. What else can I tell you about with these, with that early history? Krishna book, of course. By that time, now we started, it was clear that books like Krishna book weren't going to be printed by ISKCON Press. Prabhupada got a donation here from Mr. George Harrison for publishing the Krishna book. And that was published by the Dynapon Company, who gradually, as far as all over the rest of our hardbound books, Bhagavatam and so on, it was Dynapon up to, for many years actually. And Back to Godhead also went to Dynapon. Prabhupada had an idea for expanding the numbers beyond what ISKCON Press could do, and that was shipped to Japan also. After a couple of years, a year or so, ISKCON Press moved back to New York City, and we set up at a place called Tiffany Place, 32 Tiffany Place, which sounds like quite an upscale address, doesn't it? 32 Tiffany Place. It's like, it was, 32 Tiffany Place was a, what would you call it? It was a brick industrial building on a shoddy little street about four blocks from the waterfront in Brooklyn. It was definitely a far cry from Breakfast at Tiffany's and all of that. It was, we had the downstairs, we had the printing press, and the upstairs, we had all the pre-press work, the typesetting and shooting the films and assembling the pages and all that. And we used to keep someone in the upstairs every night for what we called loft watch, because the neighborhood was full of thieves. And without someone on loft watch, the place would be broken into and plundered. So anyway, we renovated this place upstairs and set it up, and that became our establishment. It was about a five-block walk from what was then the Brooklyn Temple. And we developed to be quite a good, quite a professional outfit, I have to say. We picked up another girl from, one of us visited Princeton University Press just to see, you know, what they're doing, pick up some ideas. Then there was one young woman there became interested, or was interested. And anyway, she joined Tukahantri Dasi. She became one of our composers and proofreaders. And from her, we picked, or from Princeton, we picked up how they were proofreading. which was with a tape recorder. It was a very interesting system, because how do you know that what you typed matches what the manuscript said? The system was that they used to have one person who would sit here and read the manuscript, and the other person would listen and read the typeset pages. And the person who was reading would read everything, like, as capital K Krishna says in the italic Bhagavad Gita comma, italic manmana bhavamad bhakta madhyaji mam namaskuru, colon, cap J, just surrender to cap M me. That's how you would read. And somebody would read the other. So you'd be sitting there, these two people, and that's how proofreading was typically done. But Princeton was very smart. They had one person read into a tape recorder, and then the other person wouldn't have to have the two people sitting there at the same time. One could read, and the other one could play the tape and proofread. So that became our system, which wasn't perfect, because you could skip from with your eye and see another word, another instance of the same word, and leave out five lines in between. There were things that happened. But generally speaking, we developed quite a good standard. Srimad Bhagavatam came out, second canto, third canto, fourth canto. At one point, the composing machines became quite difficult. IBM was making good money selling machines, and even better money on service contracts, because every office that had a Selectric typewriter or a Selectric composer for the big guys would have a service contract. You just pay quite a reasonable fee, and if you had a problem, IBM would come and fix it. They still have that now with your IBM laptops. You can pay a little fee, and they'll come fix it. That was good for an ordinary office. These machines weren't really meant for doing 24 hours a day and having the balls replaced every 15 seconds. So they were always breaking down. I mean, the guy would leave the office and, you know, 2 hours later we would call their office and say, you know, it's broken down again. Then we had at one point, a real adversarial relationship with the local IBM office. You know, we'd call them, and the guys would, like, you know, the manager would, like, not want to have anything to do with us, and it's working fine, and blah, 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 blah. And one time this was going on, I looked through the phone book at IBM to try and find somebody to speak to. And I don't know, when I got the guy on the line, I must have dialed into the heavenly planets or something. Really? Well, that doesn't sound right. We'll have to do something about that. The next day, the manager, three guys under him, they were all there. They brought us new machines. They were apologetic like nobody's business. Some of these things were going on. At one point, at some point in the 1970s, photos typesetting came along as a developing technology. Instead of what became known as strike-on technology, which is what we've been using, there was a method by which light would be shined through a spinning film. The light would shine onto photosensitive paper, and it would compose your lines that way. You'd take this paper and run it through a developing machine, and you would have high quality output. So one of my godbrothers, Chandanacharya, took me to see one of these machines. And gradually, it's a long story, I basically visited every typesetting shop in the greater in Midtown Manhattan, looked at every kind of machine there was, spoke to every kind of salesman. And finally, we bought this very impressive machine. It was a tower. You know, it had a computer that was a tower, you know, in one of those big rack things. And then the typesetting machine was a separate thing. And the tower had all these little buttons with lights. It had a not a PDP-8, Data General Eclipse, I believe they called it some. Anyway, this is, you don't know any of this. And we splurged and got an extra memory board. The memory boards were about this big, literally. So we got two of them so that we had 16K of memory in the machine. Shortly thereafter, now there's more I can tell, but anyway, shortly thereafter we moved to Los Angeles. I don't remember the internal politics that were going on, but somehow Ramishar Prabhu was in charge of, he'd taken over from Karandar, who'd been sort of Prabhupada's right-hand man for publishing at that stage. And Ramishar and Radha Balava, who'd taken over from me as production manager by the grace of God, because I was a terrible production manager. If you look through the folio, you'll find some letter from Prabhupada where he's saying, you know, just now coming, I've been hearing this for too long. When is the book going to be out? Production management wasn't my forte. So Radha Balava took over, who was very good at it, actually. And between him and Ramishar, they conspired or decided or anyway got the idea that it would be good to move the press to Los Angeles. By that time, the printing press had been sold. The printing part was closed down. But the pre-press was quite good. For us to get that work done outside would have been prohibitively expensive. Even just getting normal typesetting done, but then the sort of work we were doing was so specialized, it would have been ghastly expensive, and they wouldn't have, what would they have known about where your diacritic marks go and all this kind of stuff. So we were doing all that of ourselves. And we moved out to Los Angeles. And Prabhupada came to visit. He'd visited the press in Boston. They'd approvingly seen our setup there. At one point, Advaita asked Prabhupada, would you like to name the press? You know, like give the name, the press a name. Prabhupada said, it's already named ISKCON Press. And he looked at downstairs at the binding equipment and so on. He said, this is the heart of ISKCON. He said, this is the heart of ISKCON, the press. Prabhupada gave so much importance to the press. And Prabhupada said, so this is the heart of ISKCON. Prabhupada said, and you know who is in the heart? Yes, that's Krishna. And then one devotee said, Prabhupada, you're the heart of ISKCON. And Prabhupada said, and this is my heart. At one point, the devotees had wanted to go. There was, at that time, the Rath Yatra in San Francisco was the Rath Yatra festival. There was really only one in America, and that was San Francisco. Prabhupada was going to be there. So the devotees in Boston had a plan. We would jump into a van, drive across the country. It would take 2 or 3 days at, maximum 24-hour driving. And then we'd be there with Prabhupada for the Rath Yatra, and then we'd get back. Prabhupada heard about it. He said, they should stay back and do their service. What do they want to come out here for? So the service was more important. Then Prabhupada came and visited us in Los Angeles, and we were really set up there. We had a building on the corner, you don't know Los Angeles anyway, Watsake Avenue is where the temple is, and around the corner was another building which became the press building. And we all had offices and setups, and everything we needed was there for the editors and the proofreaders and the artists and the production people and for the cameras and the developing equipment and the photography for the illustrations, you know, everything was there. And the room with the typesetting equipment with all the lights that flashed and all of that. So Prabhupada came and he visited each office and saw how it was going on. And then the next morning was the the morning where he said on the walk that I was dreaming of something like this when I was in India. And now I think I'm 17 books ahead of you, so you can do these 17 books in 2 months. Our pace back then was one book in 2 months. And Prabhupada wanted 17. And Ramachar stammered and said something to Srila Prabhupada to the effect that this was impossible. And Prabhupada said that impossible was a word in a fool's dictionary. And what is the use of you if you can't do it? And Ramachar at that point realized that Prabhupada was serious. And he met with Radha Balava, and the rest of the story is sort of long. But we all went on to like 24-hour shifts. We went to Mangalarti, we chanted our rounds. Someplace we took prasadam, and the rest of the time was just production. You could be woken up at any part of the night and told, you know, we need you to proofread a page, or we need you to do this, or we need you to do that. Everyone was just full gear working on completing these books so that they would be done by Prabhupada's deadline, which they were. And we never had so much fun in our life. I think I've talked long enough about this. I haven't said anything about the distribution of the books, which is a wonderful story in itself. I've only talked about how they were made and not how they were distributed. But parallel to all of this was a growing movement, deployment of devotees, devotees who became inspired and charged up because Prabhupada was talking so much about the importance of distributing these books. What is the use of having them stocked up and not distributed? So Prabhupada was pushing like anything that these books should be distributed. And devotees who knew anything about how you sold a book, but Prabhupada gave a few hints and devotees took it and made some discoveries and ran with it. And soon there was just enormous book distribution going on. Men, women, everybody was out as much as possible distributing books. And then the new books would come out. And so leading book distributors like Tripurari Maharaj and others would get a new book and they'd be in the van and they'd like hole up in the van for 2 days and read the latest volume of Chaitanya Charitamrita and then go out and distribute them in massive quantities. So it was hugely ecstatic. It was hugely successful. Our temples were thriving. There were devotees. There was as much money as needed. There was not very many problems because nobody had time for them. Women's issues in those days were, how many books did you distribute? one woman would compare with another woman what her scores were. Those were women's issues back in those days. The guru issue was how many books you could distribute for Srila Prabhupada. All these issues, great issues, were non-issues because everybody was just out distributing books to people and having wonderful experiences. And that's another side of the story, which, again, we won't have time for. But if you get the opportunity, I was in the back office mainly. I was on the production side. And there were wonderful leaders, Pragoj, Tripurari Maharaj, and so many others who were the Gauri Dasi and Daivishakti Dasi, so many who were the leaders in book distribution. And if you ever get a chance to corner one of them and have them talk to you about it, by all means do so, because it's a wonderful and glorious history. Okay, I'll stop here. Any questions?